Okay, so we are very happy to have Kostas giving this seminar today on holographic cosmology, status report. If you want to ask a question during the talk, you can unmute yourself and then go ahead. Otherwise, we'll take the questions at the end of the talk. So please, Kostas, go ahead. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's a pity I cannot be there in person, but I'm happy I'm able to give this talk. I would like to encourage this discussion during the talk. So if you have a question or a comment, just unmute yourself and we can get started. Okay, so I will give basically an overview of holographic cosmology and what is its current status. I will start with a general introduction, kind of trying to put things in perspective and maybe put a little bit the bigger picture to see where we're going. And then we're going to move from generality to more specific models. So what is it? I think if there is one thing that I want you to get out of this talk is that holographic cosmology is a new framework. It's not so much a new model, it's a new framework. And so perhaps some of the models I will discuss, they're not going to be the right ones. Or perhaps some of the ideas are not exactly right, but I think this framework is here to stay. And so in short, instead of giving the traditional description of our universe as Einstein gravity coupled to some matter, then in this case, we're describing the four-dimensional universe by providing a three-dimensional quantum field theory that contains no gravity, and that's very important. And also by providing a dictionary that relates the quantum field theory observables to the four-dimensional observables. Now, in almost all of my talk, I will remain in four dimensions, and the dual quantum field theory is going to be three-dimensional. And the intention is for this to be applied to our own universe, not some other universe with other properties. And we'll see how far we're going to go. So this new framework is in particular applicable to the very early universe. And in terms of the very early universe, includes conventional inflation, but also includes qualitatively new models, which describe a non-geometric very early universe. So it's a bigger framework, where in part it produces what is already known, and in part it allows us to extend our models to a new regime. So why should we care? Why would you want to use holographic cosmology? Depending on where I give the talk, if I give the talk to people that are close to data, they say inflation, lambda CPM describes the data extremely well. Why would we want to introduce some new idea? So I would say this new framework, kind of from the theoretical perspective, contains things that we do not have with any other methods. So first of all, the models are fully consistent with quantum mechanics. General relativity itself emerges in this framework when the quantum field theory dynamics becomes strongly interacting. How exactly that happens, we do not know in full generality, we only know in specific models. But more important, most importantly, in the context of this talk, so these models are well-defined even when traditional GR breaks down, such as at the initial singularity, and I will come back to this topic towards the end of the talk. But perhaps if one takes kind of a bigger perspective, then for me it brings to a scientific domain questions which you previously consider as some sort of metaphysics, the things that you would discuss with a bottle of beer in a bar. Things like, what were the laws of physics before time and space, the way we perceive them today, exist? And perhaps, again, the methodology and the tools we're going to build are not exactly the right one, but at least it brings in mathematics and allow us to build new concepts. And I think this by itself for me is very important. I should also say that this is pretty much a work in progress and not everything is understood. And another thing that I want to come out from this talk is that this is an interesting new direction, and the more input we get, the better it's going to be. So the very early universe is the period which is usually associated with inflation, is the part which is best understood, and this would be the focus of this talk. I would first start, however, with some general and, to a large extent, model-independent implications of this framework. And then only after that, I'm going to go back and describe how to build models which describe a non-geometric very early universe. Okay, so this is the general introduction. Are there any questions or comments already at this stage? Okay, so what I will do in the rest of this talk is I will start with a very brief introduction about gauge gravity duality, so that we're all on the same page. And then I will move on to go back to these general implications. If this framework is the right framework, it implies some general picture, which I will discuss. And then we'll move on to discuss in a little bit more detail the holographic dictionary. And this would allow us to build the tools that we would need to discuss these models for a non-geometric very early universe. And then we will see how these models compare with more traditional models like Lambda CDM. And then we'll move on to go back, in a sense, a step earlier. So before people were doing CMP, still there was a need for a theory that goes beyond Hoyt Big Bang, because there were a number of classic puzzles. And we will see how this new holographic ideas address these puzzles now in a different way. And then we'll return to these models, but actually simplify them even further. Well, I'm going to discuss a very simple model, model that only contains two parameters, yet is capable of describing the data. And then I will discuss how, in the context of this model, we see the solution of the initial singularity. Okay, now what I will discuss, especially the first part of the introduction, is based on work I've done with Paul McFadden and Adam Pozovsky almost 10 years ago. Of course, this was not the first works on holographic cosmology. This builds on earlier works on the CETA CFT by Witten and Strominger, and especially on the formulation of these ideas in terms of the wave function of the universe by Maltasena almost 20 years ago. And there has been, of course, a big literature since then, which I'm not going to review all of it. But more particularly, the part which I'm going to focus on, the second part of the talk, will be based in part on things I've done with Nayesh and Beth a few years ago about fitting these models to Planck data. And then a more recent paper with Horacio Nastase on how these models resolve the classic puzzles of Hoyt Big Bang. And then the last part would be new work where we're using lattice methods in order to analyze the dual quantum field theory in the regime which is non-perturbative. And this is also the part where we're going to see explicitly this the singularity resolution. Okay, so let's start from the beginning. So gauge gravity duality. So here I'm only going to give you the headlines, otherwise I'm going to stay here all night. So what is gauge gravity duality? So it is an equivalence between two different theories. One is gravity in D plus one dimensions, and another is quantum field theory in D dimensions. So this is meant to be a true duality, like it's illustrated here. So do you see a duck or you see a rabbit? So it's the same object, but depending on how you see it, it may look differently. And that's what duality is. You may have the same physical system that looks from one perspective, like gravity in D plus one dimensions, but from another perspective as a quantum field theory in D dimensions. And as I said in the beginning, I will stay exclusively in three dimensions. And so we will be describing a four-dimensional universe, in terms of a dual three-dimensional quantum field theory. Now, the idea of holography has its origins in black hole physics, and I'm not going to go through this prehistory. Great realizations appeared in string theory that make this topic of a mainstream topic. Now, in a nutshell, gauge gravity duality provides a way to either obtain quantum field theory correlation functions of gauge invariant operators by doing some gravitational computation. And this is how this topic is mostly developed over the last 20 years, but also provides a way to describe the behavior of gravitational systems by using correlation functions of gauge invariant operators. So you can always view it in two different ways. And in this talk, we're gonna stay mostly in this second one. So we're gonna use quantum field theory in order to describe gravity. Now, one can ask, how is it that after 100 years of general relativity and 100 years of quantum field theory, we didn't notice this correspondence between the two topics? And the answer to that is because this is a strong weak coupling duality, which means that one description is weakly coupled, then the other is strongly coupled. So we know a lot about weakly coupled gravity, but it's very difficult to analyze strongly coupled quantum field theory, and vice versa. So gauge gravity duality and ADS-CFT was mostly used in this form. So one does some weakly coupled computation, solves some equations in the bulk, and then uses that to extract information about strongly coupled quantum field theory. But this is meant to be a duality that holds at all values of the coupling. So in particular, if one is looking at strongly coupled gravity, that should have a description in terms of some weakly coupled quantum field theory. And here, strongly coupled gravity doesn't just mean strong gravity, it means a regime where even the notion of space-time may not make sense. This is a non-geometric phase. So when I said earlier that we'll be describing non-geometric universes, I really meant it in this sense. So something where even the geometry doesn't make sense. So what about the additional dimension? We had the correspondence between D plus one gravity and D-dimensional quantum field theory. So in quantum field theory, the observables we compute depend on the scale that we brought to the theory. And this is captured by the randomization group flaw, which is indicated on the side of the slide. So as we go from high energies to the low energies, we have a monotonic coarse-graining of degrees of freedom. And our G scale corresponds to the additional direction. Okay, so now what about cosmology? Now, in holographic cosmology, it is now time, which is related to randomization group flow. And more particular, cosmological evolution is mapped to inverse RG flow. So here, as we start from strong gravity at a very early universe, and we move towards today, then gravity today is weakly coupled. But we now, by looking at the past, at the very past, it was an initial singularity. And this is mapped in this picture to the picture over here, where the time direction is the inverse of the RG flow. Already this picture introduces a very different formulation of the way we're meant to think about physics. So if we're, let's say, at some time to here, so usually we'd say this defines for us initial conditions, and then we use Einstein equations to kind of propagate to the future. Now here, this picture says that if we're here, this is like describing a quantum field theory with cutoff. You can describe accurately everything in the infrared, but if you only know information over here, you only have very limited information about what happens above the cutoff. Of course, if you know the theory here, you know everything underneath. So similarly here, with the information we have here, at some initial time, we can describe the past history of our universe, but we only have limited information about how to move to the future. Okay, so these are the generalities, so now I'm gonna build on those, and I'm gonna start with some general lessons which to a large extent are model independent, do not depend on how you exactly realize what is the dual quantum field theory. So the first, we just discussed a connection between normalization group flow and the cosmological evolution. But we know there are general theorems about the normalization group flows of quantum field theory. So in general, you have a monotonic flow that starts somewhere in the UV and goes down to the IR. And generally, we expect the endpoints, the UV to have a CFT, and the IR to have a CFT. So a generic prediction of this formalism is that at some point in the future, we will have a dark energy era, which is described by strongly coupled UV fixed point, which describes here. So the CFT over here is linked with the de Sitter spacetime corresponding to the positive cosmological constant. And similarly, if we look in our past, we see, and this is the favorite scenario of most people, that at the very past, we expect to have de Sitter inflation, and that corresponds to the infrared CFT. But this formalism also allows for a somewhat different description. Suppose we're not already at the very deep UV, so suppose we're somewhere at the earlier point. So this point here could also be described by some strongly coupled supernormalizable quantum field theory of the type I will describe in the second part of the talk. And this type of models are now correspond to quintessence. And similarly, if we look back to the period which from which we get CMB data, this part down here can also be governed by phase, described by a supernormalizable quantum field theory. And I will describe this scenario. This is the main scenario I will describe later on. So this is one kind of a general lesson. So the whatever is the cosmological history, it has to contain some of the expectations you have from quantum field theory in the far past and in the far future. So the second main implication is about the hour of time. So one can ask, why is there an hour of time when the macroscopic laws of physics are time symmetric? And the most common view one hears is because this just has a thermodynamic origin. And we're just moving towards, the universe is just moving towards the state of maximum entropy. So all of this is fine, but that by itself creates a new question, namely the state from which the universe started itself, there must be a very low entropic state. But then why would this be the case? So I think this has been debated over at least the last 20, 30 years. We still not completely satisfactory answer. Holography gives another view to this. So as I described in the last few slides, in holography time is inverse RG flow, and we know that normalization group flows, they satisfy, they have a monotonicity property. So the monotonicity of the RG flow explains the hour of time. Secondly, as we move towards the future, we have more degrees of freedom because there are more degrees of freedom in the UV. And last, the spatial properties of the initial state that are just linked to the fact that we have universality of infrared dynamics, no matter irrespectively of what happens in the UV, the IR is universal. Okay, so this was my general discussion. So next I will move to describe in slightly more detail the holographic dictionary, and then I will move on to discuss more concrete models. Are there any comments or questions on the stuff so far. Okay, so now let's move to the holographic dictionary. So to do quantitative physics, we need to have specific formulas that relate cosmological observables to quantum field theory correlation functions.
Kostas, do you mind if I ask you a question?
Yeah, please go ahead.
Can you prove that, the RG time it goes in one direction, or is that an assumption?
Well, this is a general expectation in quantum field theory. Mm. There's a general expectation that RG goes in one direction, so in three dimensions, and with a few more technical assumptions, there is a proof. This goes under the name F theorem.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
Any other question? Okay, so so the papers I mentioned earlier on with McFadden and Dovsky was about developing these holographic formulas, and they are very explicit holographic formulas, both for the power spectra and on Gaussianities. In the next slide, I will present the formula for the power spectra, but there are similar ones for the non-Gaussianities. So the next slide is perhaps the most technical slide. So if you have the energy momentum tensor in any dimension, and if you look at it in momentum space, then it takes the form I indicate over here. It contains two pieces. One piece is the piece associated with the transverse traceless part of the energy momentum tensor, and there is a second piece which is related to the trace part. So this capital pi is a projector to the transverse traceless piece, and the small pi is a projection to the transverse piece. So now the dictionary says that you, given your favorite quantum field theory, you compute this two-point function, and then you extract these two coefficients, and then you insert them in the formulas I indicate over here. So this part here is about the scalar power spectrum. So you take the trace part and you put it here, and this part here is about the tensors. You take this part and you plug it in there. You do need to do a suitable analytic continuation, which is not fully understood, and I'm not going to discuss too much today. But that's it is not a complicated analytic continuation. In the theories I'm discussing, you can readily do it. But there is a bigger conceptual questions behind it. But these are the formulas. These are completely explicit. Now, for non-Gaussianities, there's similarly explicit formulas, and this then involves higher point functions of the energy momentum tensor. For instance, if you want to discuss the bispectrum, then you need a three-point function of the energy momentum tensor. If you want to have the trispectrum, then you need four-point function, so on. Now, in the next slide, I'm going to indicate one way of understanding these formulas, although this is not the way we derive them in these papers, but that's an equivalent way to view it. So this is the view of the duality as computing the wave function of the universe. So then you say, and the idea is the following. So then the wave function of the universe is given by the partition function of the quantum field theory. Now on this side, these variables phi are sources that couple the gauge invariant operators, like I have them here. So phi couples to the gauge invariant operator O. And then the partition function is given by the exponential of the sum of all correlators times the sources. But on this side, what appears over here are the variables of the wave function. So now if you want to compute cosmological observables, we meant to square the wave function, this is that part, and then multiply with the operator, and then do the path integral. Now psi square from here, so you take this and you put it in here, So the leaning term is going to come from two-point functions, and the fact that we get 1 over this is because the two-point function is the inverse of the quadratic part, and so on. So that's a sketch of how you get to this formulas. Now, this specific formulas, I should say, work for arbitrary inflationary background. So if you give me inflationary background, there is a prescription on how to get to the quantum field theory. They're going to give you back the known spectrum. Okay, so but that's how it works. But from the formulation, I didn't have to say whether the quantum field theory is weakly coupled or strongly coupled. So the same dictionary also holds when the quantum field theory is weakly coupled. And that's what I'm going to do when we're going to build the models for non-geometric universes. So before I move to that, any questions on the dictionary? Okay, so to have concrete models, one needs to discuss what is the dual quantum field theory. Now, a priori would be great if we can have a first principle derivation of the dual quantum field theory. This is not something we currently have. So we can postulate quantum field theories and analyze the implications. Of course, you cannot put just anything you would like here. There have to be some kind of field theory that we know that is a working holographic dictionary. And there are two classes of quantum field theory where we do know that some of them are holographic. One is conformal field theories, which are associated with under the city space times. And the other class is this class of supernormalizable theories, which are cousins of the maximally supersymmetric Chupin-Mills theory in 3 dimensions. So these are associated with the D2 brain rather than the D3 brain. What is important here is that all of the terms I list over here, if I associate dimensions as if the fields were 4-dimensional, they have the same dimension. So this is dimension 4, because gauge fields have dimension 4, I have two derivatives. Again, 4 dimensions 5, we have dimension 1, and this is dimension 4, and then the Fermi will have dimension 3/2. So then, once we go to 3 dimensions, then the Young-Mills coupling now has dimension 1, and all other quantities that appear here are dimensionless. Now, this implies in particular that if I promote this coupling to a field, then one can show that this Lagrangian has conformal invariance. Of course, coupling should not transform, so it's not really an invariance, but it's an underlying structure. So we call this a generalized conformal structure. So quantum field theories that have an underlying conformal structure, they have also a corresponding dual that has a similar generalized conformal structure in the bulk. So that's the reason why we're looking at this type of theory. But a priori, we don't know which one to choose, so I'm going to start the discussion with putting in general quantum field theory. Another motivation for looking at this theory is that this is kind of the more general theory you can think of, which is perturbative. So it starts with quadratic terms and then has interactions. What is important is that all fields are massless. If we have massive fields, we wouldn't have this generalized conformal structure. And also, there are no kind of 5 to the 6. So 5 to the 6 terms are not allowed, even though they are normalizable. So from the perspective of this generalized conformal structure, these 5 to the 6 terms are irrelevant. Okay, so this is our theory. Now, once we have the theory, then if we want to work out the implications, we just need to work out the two-point function of the energy momentum tensor, insert it into the formulas, and then work out the predictions. So I'm gonna skip all the details on the derivation and just come up to the kind of the punchline. And the punchline is that this theory is a universal predictions, which are valid in this entire class of theory with general couplings. So the scalar power spectrum takes the form indicated over here. So it has an amplitude, it has a parameter G, which is related to the Young's coupling constant, and has another parameter beta. This Q star is a dimensionful parameter. Its precise value just defines the units. But one should contrast this with what we have in kind of standard inflationary models, where instead of having this, you have some delta naught, and then you have K to NS minus one. So instead of, Q. So instead of being kind of a power law behavior, we have this kind of logarithmic behavior. And the same is true for the tensor power spectrum. It has, again, a similar type of form. So this is true for all these classes of theories. It just follows from the existence of the generalized conformal structure. Now, there are also universal factors about the non-Gaussianity. So in particular, the scalar non-Gaussianity has two pieces. It has no local piece and has an equilateral piece with a very specific FNL. So if FNL equilibrium was found, which is, let's say, equal to 2, this would rule out all of these models. Plus, as a component that an orthogonal component. Okay, so now one can ask, given the CMB data, do the data prefer this form of the power spectrum or that form of the power spectrum? So this is the question we asked with Nyash and Beth and Claudia and Luigi a few years ago. And this is the answer. So this is from this paper, 2017. So in this plot, I have the Planck 2015 data versus Lambda CDM versus the holographic model. So the red curve is holographic model. The dotted blue is Lambda CDM. And I guess you can't really see the difference. And then in the insert, we have this very low part where you can actually see there is a difference here and there. Now, of course, one shouldn't do physics with the eye, but nevertheless, let's also look at the residuals. These are the residuals. So this shaded green area is the error bar of Planck. And then this black line, this one here, is the difference between Lambda CDM and the holographic model. You can see the difference is within the error bar. And then the blue dots are Planck minus Lambda CDM, and the red asterisk is Planck minus holographic cosmology. Well, with the eye, they look like they do almost the same. And of course, again, one should be quantitative, and that's the punchline. First of all, in deriving this form of the power spectrum, we assumed that the theory is perturbative, namely that the coupling constant is small at all for all available scales. Now, since this theory contains a dimensionful parameter, the relevant coupling is really the effective coupling, which is formed by the Young-Mills coupling and the relevant scale. So if you look at the Qs that we see in CMB, then one can ask whether the effective coupling is small. So indeed, for all the scales C in CMB, except at very low multiples, this is very small. It starts with something like 10 to minus 4 around here, and starts to become of order 1 around there. So in all this other region, this one here, it's perturbative. So the perturbative assumption is a posteriori justified by the fit to the data. So as I said, for multiples less than 30, the model becomes non-perturbative. And this gives the motivation for one of the motivations for the last part, where I will discuss using lattice methods. So one cannot trust the perturbative prediction. And then if you compare how the models do in the regions when they're both applicable, namely when L is greater than 30, then these are the values of chi-square, and you can see there that they're different by less than one sigma. So the actual data cannot tell apart, the CMB data cannot tell apart whether lambda CBM or this model is correct model, the correct model describing. Now, once you do the fit to the data, one can ask a more detailed question. You can say, among all of these models we started from, do the data discriminate some of them? Do they rule out or rule in or rule out some? And the answer is yes. So the data is strong enough to rule out some theories, in particular if you have SUN theory coupled to fermions only, this theory is ruled out. On the other hand, if you have an SUN gauge theory coupled to only scalars with a phi to the four interaction, this is ruled in. This has to be non-minimal, meaning that the energy momentum tensor would contain, apart from the standard terms, it would contain also an improvement term with a parameter, which is an additional parameter. So this model essentially contains four parameters: the coupling, the phi to the four self-coupling, this non-minimality parameter, number of colors, and the number of scalars. And actually, one of them is almost irrelevant. So you can this doesn't play any role. In this specific model, you need these three parameters to fit all the data. So the next, the last part of the talk, I will actually discuss an even simpler model that only has two parameters. Okay, so this model definitely is definitely compatible with data. But of course, this is only one part of the story. So inflation was not created only to describe CMB. Actually, it was created before CMB data were readily available. So it was basically created to address puzzles associated with Hodgkin Punk. So if this model is to be on equal footing as kind of standard lambda CDM, one should also check whether this model addresses the same puzzles or not. Because if it doesn't address the other puzzles, then this would be ruled out by other reasons, not because of the CMB. So now what I will do next, discuss how these holographic models address my part before I move to this. Okay. So the puzzles that I will address is the following three questions: why the universe is uniform and isotropic, why is it the flatness problem, and the Rayleigh or monopole problem. And as you will see, the answer to these questions is very different from, or at least have a very different form than the answer conventionally given by inflation. So I will start by very briefly reviewing the problem, how this is addressed with inflation, how it's addressed with these new models. Okay, so so let's start with the question of, you know, what is the problem with the universe being uniform and isotropic? Okay, I think this is best illustrated with a diagram. So this diagram I stole from the book of Baumann and McAllister. So this is what we're here, and this is the time of combination, the CMB creation. So suppose we're here and we look at two different directions in the sky. So we know that what we see today is very uniform in no matter which direction we look. But these two points here, they didn't have any chance to communicate with himself. If you look at the past light guns, since the space-time ends at the initial singularity before the light guns had the chance to communicate. So this, in a sense, rules out hot Big Bang cosmology as being the only theory, that there's nothing before that. Okay, so with inflation, the fix is sort of simple. So you just add another period before that. So now, provided this is long enough, this point here, they can be in cause of conduct. And now if our entire universe is created from this patch, then this explains why everything we see in the sky is so uniform. Of course, this creates another question, whether this is generic or not. Okay, so now I'm going to address this issue with holographic cosmology. And by the way, before I do this, so recently there were discussions of a swap lamp. So if you kind of allow this to be, the number of fifth formulas to be long enough, then the modes that we see here, they may have had Trans-Planckian frequencies further down. And so one may think that one should exclude these models. As you will see in the next slide, I don't think there is any... I mean, one can build models where the universe was non-geometric at very early time. So this is not really an issue. Okay, so here is how it works with holographic cosmology. So holographic cosmology is, so here is the same phase. So this upper part is the same upper part as here. And now instead of having inflation on the bottom, we have this phase of holographic inflation. So again, time goes in this direction, and this corresponds to inverse LG flow over there. So in our current understanding of how to build these models, we only have a model for kind of this part of the diagram. So the dual quantum field theory I had in my earlier slides just describes this part. And over here, we do some sort of instant reheating. So we glue this. So this, the end of that period, provides initial conditions for the subsequent evolution with Einstein equations as usual. So it would be great if we develop a theory that also includes that part holographically. But for now, we're going to stay with this model where we describe this holographically, gives initial conditions there, and then subsequent evolution with Einstein equations over there. Now, if we look at two points, okay, we know exactly when this is going to be connected. So if you have a geodesic that connects the two, this is just the two-point function. This just describes the two-point function from the perspective of the dual quantum field theory. And this is the same two-point function we discussed earlier for describing the power spectrum. Then the correlation between these two points is just the standard correlations in quantum field theory. Now, if it turns out that this period here is geometric, so we're not in one of these non-geometric models, we are in one of the models that can describe, for instance, De Sitter inflation. So this just reproduces pretty much the same discussion over there. So now, in this case, the number of faulting. So if this distance is the distance between the two points, then you can show that the depth with which this geodesic goes is related to the length we see over here. And the depth with which the geodesic goes is related with how far down the randomization group flow we have been. So for the geometric models, one asks the question, up to which point this is a geometric space-time. And then this is the analog of the infaulting, the analog of a number of infaultings. But in this new context where we have a quantum field theory which exists in a sense at all times, the only issue is whether there is a singularity in the infrared or not. If there's no singularity in the infrared, this RG flow in a sense continues indefinitely, then any two points will always be connected by a deep enough normalization group flaw. So from this perspective, there's never an issue. So the normalization group flaw puts all points in causal contact because you can always go deep enough in the infrared. So the last part of the talk would be about discussing this infrared issues, whether infrared singularities or not. And whether there is an infrared singularity is really related to the question whether there is kind of the resolution of the initial singularity. Okay, so any questions on this?
So, Costas, I have a question again. So I just wanted to, if you could clarify what you mean by geodesic over there, because it looks like you have a non-geometric phase. So, and you have a geodesic going through it.
Okay, so this diagram here is valid both for the cases where I have a non-geometric phase and also in the case where this is a geometric phase described, for instance, by an asymptotically distributed space-time. So this geodesic is only valid when there is a geometric space, like space. And then this reproduces kind of the usual explanation you see over here. So this explanation that I have over here, from one hand, reproduces the usual explanation with inflation. On the other hand, when you move to the new models, explains why there are no such issues in the new models.
So the geodesic is not really applicable to the non-geometric. So
yeah, the geodesic is not applicable to the non-geometric. What is applicable is if you look at two points, then the correlations are coming from the two-point functions.
Okay.
And this would be have the usual connection you have with two-point functions. So if you have a long enough G trajectory, this would connect the different points.
Thank you.
Okay, so now about the flatness problem. So observation tells us that the universe is approximately flat today. Now, if the universe was exactly flat in the past, then the cosmic evolution would preserve this property, would be exactly flat today. But if the universe is only approximately flat today, and of course, with the accuracy we have, we don't know what this is exactly zero or approximately zero, but if it is only approximately zero, this means that it had to be extremely flat at initial times, and that now this is an issue of fine-tuning. Now, the way this is resolved by inflation is because inflation naturally drives omega very close to one. Now, with the holographic models, it would be a rather different mechanism. Now, as I have been emphasizing in this talk, in holography, time evolution is a normalization group flaw. So then the question we need to ask is, how does the space where the field theory lives changes under normalization group flaw? Now, if we put a quantum field theory on a flat background, then clearly it will remain on a flat background under normalization group flaw. So when we discuss QCD and we think how it changes under normalization group flaw, this doesn't change the fact that it lives on a flat background. So this statement here is the statement I made over here, that if the universe is exactly flat in the past, it would remain exactly flat today. So if you put your quantum field theory on a flat background, it will remain on a flat background. So now the second part of the question is, what happens if you don't put the quantum field theory exactly on a flat background, but on a small deformation of it? So suppose now we deform the background and we put it on a metric which has the flat background plus a small deformation. So if we do this, now we need to apply the rules of gauge gravity duality. So this bulk field, so the bulk metric would couple to the energy momentum tensor. So now our theory is deformed to become the original one plus the new coupling. Now, once we deform a theory, the question is, what happens in the UV? Because the UV is, again, is the is the future. So if this operator here is marginal, then if it is either marginal or irrelevant, it will have an effect in the UV. But if it is relevant, then as we go to the UV, the effect of this operator would be washed out. So this coupling would go to zero as you go to the UV. And therefore, the theory would return back to the flat background described by this metric. So this is the analog of having omega, which is equal to 1. So what we need to do is we need to determine whether the energy momentum tensor in this deformed theory is marginal, relevant, or irrelevant. So now that's a computation you can do on the quantum field theory side. So we need to compute the anomalous dimension of Tim Nunu. And this you can compute perturbatively by looking at the two-point function, because the two-point function of the energy momentum tensor is in momentum space is related to the dimension of the operator. So the energy momentum tensor before we deform the theory has dimension 3. That's also what explains this form over here. And this is the form of the two-point function in perturbation theory to two loops. So this one, this term here comes from one loop, and this term here comes from two loops. So now if we're close enough to the UV, you can re-exponentiate these terms to write it in this form. And then delta is now the anomalous dimension. Now if you do the math, this delta here turns out to be given by this quantity. And then the question is whether this quantity is positive, negative, or zero. So for this specific theories, and from the fit to the data, we know that F is negative. Actually, even theoretically, most of these theories contain F1, which are, there's a very, very small phase space where this F is positive. So indeed, since delta is negative, this operator is relevant, and therefore the flat geometry is an attractor. So that's how we resolve the flatness issue. So finally, about the relics. So we haven't seen any relics from the very early universe, such as monopoles from gap phase transition. And one can ask why. So inflation, the answer of inflation is that inflation just dilutes them. So now I'm going to briefly discuss a mechanism that suppresses them in holographic cosmology. So again, like in the previous case, we need to turn this question into a quantum field theory problem and then analyze it on the quantum field theory. Now, if we turn a field in the bulk, if we have a monopole in the bulk, like in the case I was discussing earlier with the deformation, this means that we turn on a new coupling in our quantum field theory. So we take our quantum field theory and then we deform it with the gauge field from the bulk times the corresponding magnetic current. So now the effect of the monopole will be washed out if this current over here has negative anomalous dimension, one computed in this theory or not. And like in the case we discussed over here, this requires a two-loop computation, which we have done. And I'm not gonna describe the details here. This would appear in the forthcoming paper and appeared also in the paper we already had, kind of the summary of it, this paper. So this two-loop computation indeed shows that the dimension is negative and therefore the effect of the monopoles is diluted in the future. Okay, so that finishes the section about how we address the Hopping Bank puzzle. So any questions on this part? Yeah, Naish?
Sorry, it's me again. So you said that data prefers negative anomalous dimension. Which data are we talking about?
Well, I mean the fit that we did together. So okay, F1, so
Cosmological data, okay.
Yes, cosmological data. So I F1 see. Turns out to be negative. Mm. Also, you need F1 to be negative for the spectrum to be red.
Right.
In red spectrum, then F1 is negative. And then this now links the fact that the spectrum is red to the fact that there's no flatness problem in holographic cosmology.
So how about the case with the charge? Is that also based on the fit to Planck data, or is that something more generic?
No, for the case with the charge, this is based on the specifics of the model. And in this case, we have done the computation in a specific model. So I don't know whether in a more general model that would continue to be the case. So that could discriminate between different holographic models. Okay. So some of them may be able to resolve the problem. I mean, the simplest one that we thought actually had the property that has a negative anomalous dimension.
Okay.
There may be more complicated ones, and then that would give you a way to discriminate between them, because one will have a problem with relics and the other not.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any other question? Okay, so now we're going to go to the last part. So I'll start by introducing a yet simpler model than what I've been discussing earlier, and then I will then we'll see how in this specific model we see how the resolution of the initial singularity. So this is the model. So previously we saw that data prefer to gauge fields coupled to scalars. So I'm just going to drop the gauge fields altogether. And instead of having many scalar fields, I'm just going to have one scalar field. So this is the theory. So we have a non-minimally coupled massless scalar with this action. So this is an SUN theory. Non-minimal means that, again, the energy momentum tensor contains this improvement term with the coefficient xi. Now, two loops, in this case, the two-loop analysis is almost back of the envelope, and this is the answer that one gets. So now we can count parameters. Now, it turns out if you don't have gauge fields, you can scale away lambda. So we only have two parameters, the rank of the gauge group n, and this non-minimality parameter xi. Now, n is related to the smallness of the amplitude of the primordial perturbations by just using the dictionary I discussed earlier. And xi is related to the tensor to scalar ratio. So by just fixing this to numbers, everything else then works automatically. So I have a model with two parameters. So let's see how it does with the data. Okay, this is the feature data. Okay, now again, there are two curves, one blue and one red. And okay, you can't see the difference, but perhaps you can see that this low, very low part, there is a spike here. So this definitely doesn't describe the data well at the very low Ls. But actually, one can check what is the value of the effective coupling when you do the fit to data. And one can see that the effective coupling becomes bigger than one at around L160. So I mean, somewhere here. So definitely you cannot trust the predictions that came from this kind of two-loop computation. This came from two loops. So if the coupling constant is bigger than one, there's no reason to trust the two-loop computation. So then one can ask, so if I restrict myself to this portion, which is again this one, how does this compare with lambda CDM just compared on this portion? Okay, here's again the residuals, and I'm omitting the numbers, but the punchline is that if we just restrict ourselves to this portion of the data, then this new model is 2 sigma better than the lambda CDM. Of course, I'm throwing away a lot of data, so one should not take seriously this fact. But okay, that's an indication that perhaps it's interesting to look further into this specific model. But to really properly compare the two models, we also need to find a way to model properly this earlier part of the spectrum. And for that, since the coupling constant is large, we need a method which is non-perturbative. And the only currently known method which can deal with such a situation is lattice methods. So that's how we move to using lattice. So now the aim is to use lattice methods to compute the observables in this low L region. And then once we have this, one can ask how the model does compare to lambda CDM. And in addition, it's well known that at very low Ls, around L equals 20 or so, there are this large angular anomalies in CMB sky. So this presents now an opportunity, perhaps a new model with this sky, better this portion of the data as well. But moreover, this model is simple enough that we can now start addressing the issue of how this initial curvature singularity is resolved. Okay. So what do we need to do? Okay, this is a long list, and I'll tell you in the last 5-10 minutes how far we've gone. So we need to discretize the model, which is simple. Then we need to find the massless point, which I will explain in a minute. Then we need to compute the energy momentum tensor, which is non-trivial on the lattice because the lattice breaks translational invariance. This we almost done, but I'm not gonna tell you very much. And then once we do this, then we need to compute the two-point function and we'll have some progress here. And finally, compare with Planck data. So we're not there yet. So I'm just gonna summarize the progress so far. Okay, so we need to simulate the theory at the massless point. And this requires introducing a bare mass and then fine-tuning its value so that the theory becomes massless in the continuum theory. Now, if you do it in perturbation theory, you can actually compute what these corrections need to be. And this is the value in lattice perturbation theory to two loops. Now, there is a one-loop part and a two-loop part. Now, the two-loop integral that appears over here is actually logarithmically divergent. So this is not an accident that you get this logarithmic divergence. This is a generic feature of these theories. So these theories I have been discussing are supernormalizable. And for the same reason, they have good UV behavior. They have very bad infrared behavior. There are infrared singularities in perturbation theory. So if these infrared singularities persist also non-perturbatively, this means these theories are really sick because they're non-predictive. Even though you may wish to stay all in the perturbative regime, there's still coefficients that you cannot compute. Now, it has been argued long ago, in 1981, by Jakiev, Tableton, and a separate paper by Appelquist and Pisarsky, that these theories are actually non-perturbatively infrared finite, and they even presented a mechanism. They said that the Young-Mills coupling effectively acts as an infrared regulator. So they've done this in a number of toy examples, and we'll see support for this specific model from the lattice computation in a few minutes. So they said, suppose you do perturbative computation and you put an infrared regulator. Now, if you do a non-perturbative computation of the same quantity, then you would find roughly the same answer, where in the place of the infrared cutoff, you find the Young-Mills coupling. Now, as I emphasized throughout this talk, time evolution in holographic cosmology is inverse RG flow. So then the fact that we have this infrared singularity is the image, the holographic image of the bulk initial singularity. As we go back in time, there is a singularity in the bulk and there is a naive infrared singularity in the quantum field theory as well. But now the quantum field theory has a built-in mechanism to resolve the singularity as sketched or as argued in these papers. Okay, so now to describe a little bit the evidence for this resolution, I have to explain a little bit how to find this massless point non-perturbatively. And this is done by a method which is called Biedig-Gumulants. So suppose we start with a mass in the continuum which is positive. So then we are in a symmetric phase of that theory, which means all expectation values vanish. On the other hand, if the mass in the continuum is negative, then we're in a spontaneously broken phase, and this means that expectation values are now non-zero. So then to find the massless point, you're looking at intersections of, you compute this ratio, and you see its shape. So this is actual data. So in the continuum theory, you would expect something like this. On a lattice, on a finite volume, of course, you don't see exactly a step function, but you see this interpolation. And as you change the lattice volume, here is the lattice sites that we consider for this specific case, then the curves intersect. And the intersection gives you an indication, allows you to compute exactly what is the massless point. Okay, so now on a lattice, clearly on a finite volume, you get finite answers for this mass. What is it? For this delta m. But of course, the lattice itself, the volume of the lattice acts as an infrared regulator. So there are two relevant scales in the problem. One is the Young-Mills coupling, and the other is one over L. So now the question is whether the finite critical mass, which is determined by simulations, is best fit either by function, which either contains a log, and this would mean that in the continuum limit, we have an infrared divergence, and then you should throw away the theory, or it should contain a log G, and this would indicate that this mechanism of G-Keep Templeton, Pisarsky, and Applequist is in play, and then the theory is infrared finite. And okay, here are some plots. So this is the case for SU2. This is the case for SU4. And then the dots indicate quality of fit. So you can see for n equals 2, if you try to fit this finite mass and you put a log L, where you in the case where you have perturbative infrared singularity, you see there's no acceptable fit. Where in the case with a log G, we see that we get acceptable fits in all cases. So in the horizontal axis, I have the value. I mean, again, we have two scales, G and 1/L. And there is a dimensionless number, which is G times L. And then depending, so we did the simulation for a number of Gs and a number of Ls. And then this gives you the ratio of the highest number G over L divided by the minimum. So if this number is very small, we're in the regime where these two scales are comparable. So over here, you would expect similar results. And indeed, in the n equals 4 case, we see that there are some acceptable fits over here, but that's because these two scales are comparable. If you go to the right, then we see only one of the two cases is acceptable, is the one that contains the log G. So these are only two graphs, but we have a lot more, and then we're doing a systematic statistical analysis. Okay, so then if you extrapolate to infinity, you also find a finite value, which is the one given over here, and one also finds that there is a scaling behavior as you go towards the continuum. So on this axis here, we have the mass, so A is the lattice cutoff, L is the lattice size, G is the coupling constant, and different colors indicate different theories, which is described by the strength of the coupling constant. So We have five different cases, and the two different branches is approaching this critical point either from the Brocken phase or from the symmetric phase. And you can see that in all cases, this nicely converged to the same finite value. So I think there is a lot of evidence that indeed this theory is finite in the infrared. Okay, so if we go back to the list of the things we need to do, okay, we check that we have a discretizing model, we found the massless point. Now for the energy momentum tensor, this is almost done. And in a longer version of this talk, I would have described a bit more details. So now we need to compute the two-point function and then compare to CMB data. So I'm just going to finish with some preliminary results, not on the two-point function of the energy momentum tensor, but of a simpler quantity, just the two-point function of phi square. Now here, this curve here is the one-loop result. This curve here is two-loop, and then you can see in the middle we get the non-perturbative data from the lattice. The x-axis is the strength of the coupling constant. So as we move out here, we go to the perturbative regime, and then you can see that the lattice data nicely agree with the perturbative computations. But then as we move to the non-perturbative regime, we see that this neither goes to zero nor goes to infinity, but we get a definite prediction. And that's what we want to extract for the energy momentum tensor, and then put it back in the holographic formulas, and finally compare with data. Okay, so I think I'm already over time, so let me quickly conclude. So I think the first thing I want to emphasize is that holography offers a unified framework that contains both convention and inflation that appears as a strongly coupled CFT, but also contains new non-geometric models that are described by quantum field theory, which either has weak coupling or intermediate coupling. So this last very simple model was an example of a theory with intermediate coupling, because the coupling for a big range of the CMB data was sizable. Now, the second part I discussed was about generic predictions of that framework, and one of them is that the hour of time follows from generic properties of normalization group flows. And then the third part was about how hot Big Bang puzzles are resolved, and in this case, again, this rests on properties of normalization group flows. And finally, we discussed the resolution of the initial singularity, and in this case, this is linked to the infrared finiteness of the dual quantum field theory. Okay, thank you. Any questions?
Thank you for the talk, Kostas. We can take questions now.
I'd like to ask a question, Kostas.
Yes.
Actually, I have two, but let me start with a very simple, concrete one. So standard inflation predicts a power spectrum that's like Q to one plus some small tilt.
Yeah.
And you had this other formula that involved Q log Q. Could you just point to how do you get from that very different looking formula to just something that's almost Q to the first power, or what the value of the tilt is in terms of that formula?
You cannot really go to a form which is kind of a Q, which depends very slowly on Q. So it's really a qualitatively different format.
You get sort of a Q-dependent.
Exactly. So you get something very strong from the perspective of kind of a traditional format.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like a tilt which has a very strong running. So
right, exactly. So yeah, I was wondering, why does that match so beautifully with the data?
That's a good question. Actually, for a very long time, actually before we did the fit with NIOSH, I thought that these models are going to be rolled out precisely for that reason. And then we first did a fit with WMAP in 2011 with Rafael Fluger and Easter. And then there we found a similar result. We found that it was inconclusive. But in that paper, we finished saying the error bars on WMAP are as big as expected running. That's why we don't see it. But then when Planck comes online and we have the results, we should be able to clearly discriminate the models and see that they don't fit. But that's not what we actually get. I don't have an intuitive explanation of why this is this works so nicely.
Is it somehow that only a narrow range of cues is actually relevant at the time you match on to?
But you see, for the matching that
Big Bang,
it's really pretty much everything up to here. So from here up to, it matches all of the scales. It's
Can I clarify something? Hi, Ted.
By the way.
I think there is some confusion. Cosmologists, when they talk about power spectrum, they mean different things. I think maybe that might be what's throwing you off, that there is a dimensionless power spectrum, which is almost a scale invariant. And basically, it's this, for both inflation and for what we have, it's also the case. But then at a small cues, there would be differences that one deviates like a power law, the other deviates. Well, one is the power law all the time, and the other one basically is a constant and then becomes deviates from power law significantly. But I think what you're thinking is the dimension full power spectrum, which goes like K. Mm-hmm. And basically, I mean, what Costas was showing was he was dividing by the K factor, basically. So it would be basically one if NS was exactly one.
Right.
And yeah, so basically the point is that both of these, if NS was one and then G was zero, then they both would be constants, right?
Exactly. So G equal to zero, mm-hmm. that's the Harrison-Zeltovich. That insists the one loop result gives you exactly the Harrison-Zeltovich. And then the two loop result gives you this universal correction. Okay. Now, if G is sufficiently small, one can try to exponentiate it to bring it to this form, where you're going to have some NS, mm-hmm. NS of Q. But now if you look at the logarithmic derivatives of that, kind of U dQ of NS, so and then you look at the logarithmic derivative of that one, all of them are of the same order of magnitude to all orders. So this exhibit, in a sense, a very strong running from the traditional perspective. So it's a qualitatively different way of fitting the same data. Now, why they both agree equally well? Okay, that I don't really know.
Okay. May I ask a second question that's totally different?
Sure.
This is backing up to the biggest picture here. So it seems like what you've got is a theory of the matter quantum fluctuations, but I would have thought that I needed this wave function of the universe that you've deduced from this field theory to satisfy the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, to have metric arguments and to have you know, Einstein's equation built into it.
No, it does.
And probably it does, but I just missed that part of it.
In the geometric regime, it does. Of course, not in the in the regime. So this G here, so this phi, it can also be a metric. And then what I have over here, so this would be the metrics on the three slides.
But yeah, but the thing is,
here
those
I
are...
have a maximum momentum tensor.
But that's an external...
If I'm in the regime where this is geometric...
Yeah.
Then this would satisfy Einstein equations.
But see, okay, so I want to know why. Because I don't see the path integral over the metrics that would normally have enforced the Einstein equation.
Well, I mean, this would be this part here, right? So when I compute this is just gives you the wave function.
No, but that's just an that's an expectation value. I mean, if you go back to what defined the wave function in the first place, it was the partition function.
In the geometric regime, this part here is just the same statement of kind of the same as an alias CFT. So for the same reason, the of course in that case it's not a wave function. It's the path integral on the gravity side. But I mean, you can explicitly check in the geometric regime that this quantity here would satisfy Einstein equations if you use the rules I give over here. Now, in the regime where I'm using the theory where I want to the perturbative quantum field theory, then they shouldn't satisfy Einstein equations because we're in a non-geometric regime and in general doesn't satisfy Einstein equations.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, are there any more questions for Kostas?
Yeah, sorry, one question. Do you expect in the non-geometric regime to have some string corrections or whatever? So how string can fit in this picture?
Yes, I do actually. I think it is one of the interesting questions is to try to see, to work out observables that we're gonna string kind of observables. That will be encoded in the spectrum. For instance, you expect to have high spin operators, which have low anomalous dimension. Actually, precisely these high spin operators exclude kind of weakly coupled CFTs as describing the kind of the very early universe, because then you get instabilities. But for this other models, there's no obvious reason why this should not be there. And this is something, okay, was in a different version of the talk, was one of the things that one should work out. What are the kind of stringy observables that come out of this model?
Oh, I see. And can maybe also give a mechanism in the gravity side on how this resolution works in the early universe? So how can you resolve the singularity using also string corrections and so on? Because now you have an explanation of, it seems like on the dual CFT side.
Okay, so in general gauge gravity duality, there is a so-called UV-IR connection. Mm-hmm. So things which are UV on one side are IR on the other. And I think these are mostly understood, let's say if you look at UV divergences on the quantum field theory, these are related with infrared divergences in the on-shell action. But the same holds the other way around. So UV issues on the gravity side would be related to the IR issues on the quantum field theory. But UV issues on the gravity side, okay, we only know how to deal in the context of string theory, but string theory, we only know how to analyze if the background is flat. But here we want it in a cosmological context. So suppose one is able to build string theory on this cosmological background for this very early universe. In principle, in a sense, the bulk should be described by some strongly coupled sigma model. And then one should be able to see this resolution, this IR resolution I was describing in this kind of sigma model theoretic language. But that's a very hard thing to do. People have thought about string theory and cosmological backgrounds for a long time. And the question is not tractable in that language. I think the power of holography is it makes tractable questions that other formalisms, they're not tractable in different formalisms.
Yeah, I see exactly the point. Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank
you. Yeah, so I don't think, are there any more questions? Okay, if not, let's thank Kostas. Kostas, thank you for the talk.
Yeah, thank you for having me. And thank you for listening.
Yeah, bye.